House Committee on Revenue for March 1st, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, as you see, we have a full House today, and I'm going to try to move along as expeditiously as we can. We're going to open first the public hearing on HJR 9. We have a school superintendent from the outer edge of the universe, otherwise known as Crane, I think. And so we're going to open that first, and we're going to hear from our staff and then from Representative Bentz and our guest from Crane. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HJR 9 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow the surviving or successor district following a merger of a union high school district and a common school district to maintain respective permanent rate limits of each taxing district before the merger. So Constitution says when there is a merger or consolidation, the consolidated or merged district will have one rate. Now, in this case, they want to maintain two separate rates. So that's, but it's a constitutional matter, and we have Rep. Bentz and Superintendent here to
Superintendent
explain.
Hawley. Great. Thank you. Gentlemen, please explain to us why we need to amend the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Cliff Bentz, District 60. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. I'm joined today by Superintendent Matt Hawley from Crane, who drove over for this hearing. The situation is fairly straightforward. Crane Elementary School has 79 students. Crane High School has 67 students. The buildings are about 5 feet apart, but the district that the elementary school is in is also another five schools,
seven
schools scattered out across the county. And then the Crane High School by itself. The challenge here, because we want to merge the two, which would save $50,000 a year by combining different things that folks do there, is to make sure that the tax rates in the two districts don't change. And this requires this constitutional amendment proposed under HJR 9. It's very simple, and the issue is, can we get it on the ballot so that we can allow these districts to make that choice to maintain their existing rates following a merger? And I think I've summarized it. But the superintendent can add to it.
Great. Please state your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
For the record, my name is Matthew Hawley, PO Box 751, Crane, Oregon 97732, and I am the superintendent of Harney County School District 1J and Harney County School District number 4.
Okay. And you traveled how far to get here today?
Oh, 300 miles.
Yeah, thereabouts, okay.
Hop, skip, and a jump. We drive 30 miles to go to the grocery store, so it's not a big deal.
Thank you. Help us understand this measure.
I'm here in support of HJR 9. I was charged with the task of pursuing merging of Harney County District 1 and Number 4. I truly feel it's my responsibility to be fiscally responsible to our taxpaying constituents and provide the best educational experience to our students. Merging the districts would increase our proficiencies, eliminate duplication of expenses, enhance educational programs, and use state school funds in a more fiscally responsible manner. Pursuit of this merger is only supported by our boards if the constituents of the Harney County School Districts and the seven feeder schools can be held harmless of any tax increases. And with the current statute, that's not possible. The tax increase would raise from a 2.4 to 3.46, and we just cannot support that. The school boards of 1J and 4 cannot support any type of tax increase to our rural feeder schools. And so we would, in the best interest of finance and to our student population, we would like to be able to merge without having to face the tax increase, because we cannot support that.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, let's start at Rep. Marsh and then Rep. Smith-Warner.
My only question was specifically around the language saying a union high school district and a common school district. Is there any reason it has to be those disparate entities in this measure? I mean, what if you have two high school districts merge? Or
There is only one high school district, and it is, I think, if I'm correct, there's only one Union High School left in the state, and then that is us. If we take the, we get an extra weighting in our state school fund. We get a 1.2 weighting for every student because we are a Union High School. If we merged, we would become a common school district, and we would lose that extra weighting per student, per ADMW, per ADMR at our high school. Mm-hmm. But currently, our elementary school gets funded at 0.9 instead of 0.10 because it does feed into a Union High School, so we receive less funding. When you merge those two together, we end up actually getting about 1.0, which is what everyone else across the state receives. So there really is becoming a common school district. There is a change in revenue, but the revenue really balances out with the two districts combining.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Superintendent. Thank you, Representative Vince. Can you just lay out, here is what, so the why of right now, it's that when these two kinds of district merge, they're required to go to the higher rate, and this would eliminate that. Could you just lay out the what happens now versus what this will have happened, please?
So at the risk of being maybe not quite as technical as I should be, I'll explain it this way as I was going through it yesterday, where you have different rates in two different districts that are going to merge. You add the two together, and then you divide by the permanent rate, and you come up with your resulting rate that applies to both. Okay. Thus, one goes up, one goes down. And that's we're trying to avoid having those out in these just far away, scattered out school districts suddenly be paying more by reason of having merged simply one small school that was adjacent to the high school. So the ones that are scattered out across, and by the way, these are huge distances. In the normal course, I would never support a consolidation because people have to drive so far. But this is 5 feet apart, so this makes absolute sense, but not at the cost of driving up the rates of people far, far, far away from this particular grade school. So, but that's my understanding of how it works. Today could give us a much more refined explanation. But
just to follow up, so what this would do, that instead of requiring that, it would instead determine, say that the lower rate is what state, like what is the specific language that this would do?
No, the way the language reads is that following the merger, the board can retain the same rates as opposed to working the merger and having then a balanced rate.
Gotcha.
That's what this would allow the board to decide to do. Yeah, it doesn't happen automatically.
Thank you.
Have I said that right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. appreciate you coming all the way, too. And I think it's a great idea. Can you talk about what impact it may have on your administrative side? Are you still going to have just one superintendent? Will you get rid of one and merge into one? I don't know how you're currently structured, but will there be any efficiencies from the personnel standpoint with this merger?
Yes, we currently have, I am the superintendent of both districts. That will remain the same if they merge. It would be, the efficiencies are, we duplicate everything we do. So when we have an audit for each district, it's $13,000 a district.
Yep.
When we pay for student database systems, everything that we pay for twice because we are two separate districts. The cost allocations, the time by our staff, you know, state reporting. Instead of having 32 state reports, we have 64. We duplicate everything that we do, and it's not cost effective. I would like to take those funds and put them back into a teacher, an elective class that we can provide a comprehensive education to our students. We're very rural. We're struggling to survive in these rural areas. Our student populations are dropping. And so if we could take these funds and better use them to provide the best education we can for our students, it just seems like a much better use of funds to me.
Very good. Good answer.
Thank you. Tell me a little bit about the districts. Are these overlapping districts? Do they have a contiguous boundaries? Describe the geography a little bit.
Crane Union High draws from a demographic area of 10,000 square miles.
Okay.
We have students that come to our high school that drive 156 miles one way.
Wow.
We are one of a very few public boarding schools in the United States. Okay. So we do board students.
Yeah. Board kids out there.
Crane Elementary, like I said, is 10 feet away from the high school. You look at the facility, it looks like one district or one building, but it's actually two separate districts. Then we have seven other rural feeder districts that range anywhere from 45 miles to 156 miles spread all over the county. Well, those schools are all K through 8, but when they come to high school, they all come to Crane High School.
That was my question.
Yes.
Thank you. So for reasons I don't understand, yours was one of the, maybe the only high school district that wasn't merged with the elementary school district back when. Is that true?
That is my understanding, yeah. Yes.
Because I didn't realize that you weren't already merged.
Yes.
Okay, but so the land areas of the two districts are the same, are they?
Correct. We share the same cafeteria. We share the same gymnasium.
I'm sorry. The land area of the districts,
including
the high school district, which draws from all those other elementary schools, and the elementary school district, the land area is the same, or are they different now? The where the district boundary lines are.
They are different.
The reason for this proposal. Thank you. That's helpful. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question, but more of a statement. I just want to applaud your school districts for all that you've done. I've had an opportunity on many occasions to be at your school and to see the good work that you and your staff and the community are doing, the kids you're raising and educating. You folks are doing it right. And so I compliment you on this, and I'd be pleased to support you and the representative in this effort.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other comments? I would simply note that Oregon has strong commitments to rural schools, and we want to keep our students having to travel the shortest distance we can manage, even though there's a lot of distance between people. A proposal like this one is one that we need to consider very carefully. I wonder if you have thought about how we're going to get this passed, since it's going to be voted on by people in Portland and Goose Bay and Ontario and many other places. And I think at first blush, it's a pretty complex issue for people who don't know anything about the topic. Have you had any thoughts about that? Maybe that's directed to Representative Bentz.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's safe to say that getting it on the ballot was step number one, and how we pass it, step number two. So,
okay.
Yes, we do understand the challenge.
Right. Thank you. Representative Nose, please.
I was just going to add, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just said, I'm sure Representative Smith, Warner, and I will make sure it gets, you know, plenty of votes in the metro area. And
I got Hepner covered.
Okay. Well, Representative Hernandez, we'll help out.
We appreciate it.
Thank you. I think you probably got some support on the committee, it sounds like. All right. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, and we're going to close the public hearing on HJR 9 and open a public hearing on before I do that, I want to say that on our agenda we have two other bills which we're going to carry over to Thursday, House Bill 2407 and House Bill 2779. If you're here for those bills, go away and come back tomorrow, because we're not going to have time to hear you today. But we are opening the public hearing on House Bill 2859. I'm going to ask Kyle to give us the briefest overview, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're going to try to get as much testimony in today as we can.
There's all your sign-up sheets. That's the only one of 50
plus minutes. Oh, okay. I will note before he does that we put out sign-up sheets. This is a bill with a lot of different pieces in it. Sign-up sheets for those who wanted to talk about health, housing, nonprofits, veterans, economic development, energy, natural resources, and then whatever else we've missed. And I see that we've got a couple of people signed up on a page that doesn't have anything on it. Do we know what that is?
We just put that out. That was ours without anything.
Okay. Late people. All right. Natural resources has a number of people signed up. Housing has a couple. And then other has a couple, but the others that I've mentioned don't have anybody signed up. If you're here to testify on this bill, you haven't signed up yet, and you want to talk about any of these other topics, those sign-up sheets are still on the table, I hope. Yes? All right.
We'll put another one out.
Give us the quick statement about the bill, and then I'm going to describe how we're going to try to get through in an hour and a half.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2859, what it does is it creates and adjusts sunset dates for specified property tax expenditures. There is a list of all the expenditures contained within House Bill 2859. It's up there in OLIS, titled List of Tax Expenditures to Sunset. And the general concept for this builds upon I guess, a structure that this committee and some of the members are well aware of, and it's the tax credits sunsetting process, and that was in 2009. Essentially what was set up was a six-year sunset on all existing tax credits. House Bill 2859 will do a similar thing where it's taking a number of tax expenditures related to the property tax system, not all of them, ones that are primarily related to tax administration or exist because they're prohibited by federal law or something to that extent, are not included in the list that's up in OLS. But it's still roughly about a little over half of all property tax expenditures are in there. But working off of how the tax credit review process worked is in an attempt to try to group... In an attempt to group the property tax expenditures by like category, they've been grouped in different subject areas, and then sunsets were placed in three staggered setups. So each one gets a six-year sunset, but that's where you can see up on the screen, it's pretty small there. The first sunset date begins in 2020, the next grouping will be in 2022, and the grouping after that will be in 2024. And again, the idea was when the legislature would take a look at these, they would want to look at ones that are similar. So that's where we have ones related to health, to housing, to nonprofits would be in the first group to be examined. There are, just as a note, on a number of property tax managers already had sunset dates. That's where the adjustment comes in. And in some cases, sunset dates may be out in 2026. They're being brought to fit in with whatever category they fit. Those that have a sunset date earlier but would fit in a grouping that's later are having their sunsets extended in this House Bill 2859. So that is an attempt to get them all grouped together so they would be viewed all the same. a couple notes. ORS 315037, existing law right now requires any tax expenditure enacted by the Legislative Assembly on or after January 1, 2014 to apply for a maximum of 6 years unless otherwise specified. So there is existing law right now for enacted tax expenditures, and that's the key point there. These are new tax expenditures, not modifications to existing, but new tax expenditures created in statute after January 1, 2014 do have an automatic six-year sunset today, unless it's specified otherwise in the bill that enacts the tax expenditure. So that's an important thing to note there. And then just a quick plug to the governor's tax expenditure report, which comes out every other year, and it lists all the tax expenditures, whether it's in the personal income tax program, the property tax. So all the ones that you see on the list in OLIS are contained in the governor's tax expenditure report. There's description, there's who benefits, evaluations done by agencies. So if you're looking for more in-depth description on those, you can find it in that report. That report is also the source for much of the information that you see in the document that's up on OLIS. The estimated loss estimates for the upcoming two biennia, those come from the governor's tax expenditure report. So they're up there as well as the existing sunset dates and the name and the statutory references.
Thank you. This bill is in response to a Secretary of State's audit that recommended that the legislature review tax expenditures and determine whether or not and determine what kind of a policy we ought to have for tax expenditures. The bill that's in front of us sets up essentially a system which is similar to the one that we use for the income tax tax credits. And as I review these proposals, it is clear that approach with the six-year sunset may work very well for some of these some of these property tax expenditures, and not at all well for others. And so it would be helpful, I think, to us as we listen to your testimony, and you can talk about what you want, to hear from you about the disruption, if any, that would be caused by the proposals in the bill. If you think that we ought to have a different time period for sunsets, or if you think a different method for the legislature to actually review changes in our economy and in our business activity in a different way. Many of these tax expenditures have never been reviewed. They've been on the books forever, for nearly forever. And the question then becomes, should we be reviewing them at all? If we should, how often? and what mechanisms should be used. The mechanism we have here is one that basically requires that the legislature reestablish them near the end of the time that they're going to run in order to keep them on the books. Some other mechanism may be more useful. So what I'm going to do is call up panels. Hopefully we can get people talking about the different topics that are within the bill. Get as many people as we can. We have a two-minute clock, do we? Who's keeping the clock?
Mr. Chair.
You're keeping the clock. Just a moment, please. I'm still in the middle of this introduction. And so we'd like you to keep your remarks very brief. If you're able to do that, the briefer the remarks, the more likely we are to get more people in. If you're about to say something that you've already heard two or three times, I think it would be a good time to say, yes, I agree, and then go on to the next point you want to make. And I've got two hands, so let's go to those first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very, very quickly, being new to the committee, I want to make sure I understand this chart that was presented to us.
Please.
Where it shows 2015-17 loss, 2017-19 loss, I'm assuming those are in terms of dollars?
Yes, they are.
Okay, and then just very quickly, just so I really understand this, let's take new rural health care facilities, and it shows that in both those years there was zero lost revenue to the state. Is that how you would interpret reading that?
Representative, and I should mention these are in thousands. I didn't label that in there.
Thank you.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Really helps me.
Dollars,
when I didn't see
yes,
that. I was like, this doesn't make sense.
If you see $1,300, that's $1.3 million.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That clarifies it for me.
So these Representative are Hernandez, real
money. That clarifies
that's
the question.
That's your question as well. All right, good. Let's call our first panel, we've got one person who came at some distance. And that's, I'm not going to call him at the very beginning, but very soon. Rick Barnes, Mike Barnes, and Marcia Carr, please. I should say while they're coming up, too, that it is those of you who don't get to testify today, or even those who do, should feel free to submit anything in writing to our staff. On the agenda today is our email address, lro.exhibits@oregonlegislature.gov, and they will be added to the meeting materials for this bill that the members of the committee will review. So we try very hard to make sure everybody gets heard. Please, whoever wants to go first, and your 2 minutes starts when you say the first word.
Chairman Barnhart, and members of the committee. I'm Rick Barnes. I'm president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm here today on behalf of the Small Woodland Owners of Oregon. We are extremely concerned with the proposal of House Bill 2859 to sunset the tax provisions dealing with forest land. The special assessment for forest land and the small tract option were designed specifically for small family forest land owners. The logic of the assessments in place are as follows. One, the assessment recognizes the need to cover the annual cost of owning property for 40 to 50 years before trees mature. Controlling the carrying costs are critical, such as property taxes, fire protection fees, road maintenance, and general maintenance of our forest lands. Many landowners, my wife and I included, are counting on our forest land when we retire for revenues to supplement retirement. To be able to hold on to the property until we retire will require that we are able to afford our annual costs, property taxes included. It is essential you recognize that the land use laws in the state of Oregon greatly reduce our abilities to what we do with the forest land. We are forest landowners provide a great deal of land value to the Oregon citizens. We have restrictions on riparian areas. We leave riparian areas. Waters of the state we have to protect. We have scenic highways we have to lead, et cetera. Not only do the substantial annual costs, as I mentioned, but we have tremendous risk for as family forest land owners as well. We plant a crop and have to wait 40 to 50 years for it to mature. During this time, we have the risk of fire, disease, and windstorms, but our highest risk is political risk. Every time the legislature is in session, we are fighting efforts that will negatively impact the use of our forest land and eliminate our forest management tools. Our legislature actions will dramatically increase our management costs. and bills like House Bill 2859 will affect our ability to cover our annual costs. In closing, I urge you to consider the facts that I mentioned and not sunset the special assessment for forest lands and the small tract option. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that's a great example for how to do it. Please.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mike Barnes. I'm a small woodland owner in Yamhill County. And decades ago, the state and woodland owners, to include family owners like myself, entered into an agreement. The state agreed to tax forest land as at a rate that would allow landowners to invest in the long term needed to grow a crop of trees to maturity. The landowners, in turn, agreed to plant, to nurture, to grow the trees to maturity. When the trees reach maturity, the harvest would occur, and upon that harvest, significant income taxes would flow to the state, from the landowner who sold the trees, from the logger who harvested the trees, the trucker who hauled the logs, the mill worker who milled them into lumber, the salesperson who sold the lumber, the carpenter who built a house, the realtor who sold the house, and these and many other taxes would flow to the state as a part of that mutual agreement. If the state cancels their part of that agreement, we as landowners will be forced to do likewise. We will not provide the time, the effort, and the money required to maximize the volume of mature trees from our forests. And indeed, we may look for other alternative land uses. I know these are hard times, and at times, short-sighted solutions to current problems have detrimental consequences. This is one of those times. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Marcia Carr. I'm from the South Benton County. I'm also a small woodland owner, and I'm here to represent woodland owners as well as my own family in regards to this bill and what it would do to us. The proposed elimination of the special assessed value and changing that to the real market value would raise our taxes from $1,019.63 to $25,335 a year. The changes for our forests would be dramatic. There are just a few changes we would be forced to have to pay taxes. Our family is attached to our property. The first piece was bought in 1883 when our family came from Missouri, and a lot has happened on the property since. My dad and some others planted the trees that we have on our property in 1957 by pulling seedlings up from along the road and planting them. Dad was attached to the land, and him and mom were later able to buy the property and get it back in our immediate family. All of the land is either planted or natural regeneration now. Dad had a plan to retire, manage the property to supplement his Social Security. That would all have to change if the new taxes took effect. Mom and Dad wanted us to have the family land, knowing that their six children would also need to supplement their own Social Security. That would have to change to pay the taxes. We currently own the property for keeping our family together, keeping the water clean, the air fresh, and our land diverse as needed for wildlife. We also use our property for recreation and gathering of our friends from town. Our tree farm is currently being used for education by the OSU forestry students in a program to help improve our wildlife issues and make improvements to attract threatened species to our forest environment. That would have to change to pay the taxes. We currently have a certified tree farm which is planned for sustainable forest management by never cutting more in a year than the forest has grown since the last harvest on the property. We cut only 5 to 7 acre patch cuts to allow for what we believe and have learned through our continued education is the best wildlife for songbirds and wildlife. We would have to change to pay taxes. We have a 60-year rotation management plan. That would have to change to pay taxes. We cut some timber most years, pay our revenues to the state just like everyone else, and that would have to change to pay more taxes. We would have to cut larger areas. I've taken classes from Oregon State University to become a small woodland manager and help others manage their property. The management plans would change because they would have to harvest their timber on small acreage to pay the taxes. I have worked on our family properties as well as my siblings, my kids, and grandkids. So it would be a huge loss for our family and our values if these forests had to be cut to pay taxes. Again, I'm asking for the special assessed value to remain in place so we don't have to cut all of our timber to pay taxes.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Next, we'll have Tom Brawley, Bill. I've got another set of brothers, I guess. Tom and Bill Brawley, and is it John Iverson? I'm sorry. Oh, Representative Boone, did you want to testify? Okay. Why don't you let the representative? I didn't realize she was here. And our etiquette lets representatives go first so they can get back to whatever they were doing.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for accommodating me. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I apologize. I was upstairs watching your committee and realized this is the bill I wanted to say something about. And just the previous panel just really well said it for me, and I did hear your comment if I agreed to say I agree and move on. And just wanted to add, I do support what they all said in the last speaker. I don't know her name, but that could be my story, too. I have 125 acres of forest in Clatsop County, and we log very rarely and very carefully, and we use the Swedish method and vegetable oil for our hydraulic fluids. So I'm one of those. But I am a past member of the Small Woodlands Organization and have met with them before. And I totally agree with this. This is, they listen to them, listen to their stories. I could not say it better. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please go ahead.
I'm happy to be here, happy you're here, and happy that you're open to the public comment. I'm a family farmer from Marion County.
If you would state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Brawley.
Tom, thank you.
And I'm here on short notice, very short notice. We received information last night, and it was quite scanty, so I hope you'll bear with us. Farming generates, as probably most of you know, $50 billion a year in the state of Oregon. Most of it comes from family farms, and we would be devastated by this bill. I'll just address the equipment issue, which I understand is under personal property. It has been recommended to our equipment. We need equipment to harvest. We need equipment to plant. Our equipment is used approximately 3 weeks to 3 months a year. The rest of the time, it's parked. And so it's a major line item for us, and we cannot afford to pay taxes on it because we've already paid taxes on the purchase of that equipment, on the money that we use to purchase the equipment. So I ask you people to consider all the things you're going to hear from farmers today. And if you need some money to fill your shortfall, please look and reconsider how you spend the money you've got now. That's what we have to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Bill Brawley, and we aren't brothers. We're father and son, just in case.
I figured that out. Thank you.
I think that was more of a compliment to him than it was to me. But, I am also a farmer in Marion County here in Oregon, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here just to speak with the committee. And we haven't done all the research we'd like to do. Just like as Dad mentioned, we're here on short notice. But from what I understand, if House Bill 2859, if it passes,
that's when he's talking about it.
It will increase the tax rate on EFU farmland 700 to 800%. That bears a little bit of research. I haven't been able to do all that research, but it's come from a reliable source. Please take the time to research that for us, and I'm sure we'll do the same. But that's what I understand. And an increase of that magnitude for any business would be catastrophic. And that's no different for agriculture than for any other business in this state. And we've also just had an increase on minimum wage. And if you compound minimum wage increased EFU taxes, and if you added equipment tax, increased equipment tax to it, that would be extremely difficult for the farm community to handle. It would render farm agriculture in Oregon unsustainable. It would put us beyond the threshold of being able to maintain our industry. So I would like you to consider shutting this bill down, and appreciate your attention to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is John Iverson. I'm a third-generation family farmer outside of Wilson. Very, very concerned about the repealing of this. I'd like to start by reading 308A.050, the legislative intent of something that you're striking out. This says, the Legislative Assembly recognizes that agriculture and related land uses contribute significantly to Oregon's character and economy. The Legislative Assembly finds that providing the means for agriculture to continue and prosper is in interest of all citizens of the state who benefit directly or indirectly from agriculture production and stewardship of farmlands and ranchlands. So this bill is really concerning. It goes on to say that it recognizes that farmland can be used for higher value purposes, but the law restricts it to farm use in many examples. So it'd be unfair to tax at higher rates since it couldn't be used for higher value purposes. Like they said with the equipment, we run a lot of equipment a couple times out of the year, combines and stuff. They're very expensive equipment. I mean, we run stuff that's 35, 40 years old to stuff that we call brand new, which is 20 years old. And that would be all taxed significantly higher than it is right now. This is all coming at a time that the USDA is predicting that farm income will drop 9% this year. It's the fourth year of a continued slide, the largest slide since the Great Depression. Right now, we're getting wheat prices that are the same in the 70s, not adjusted for inflation, the same price they were in the 70s. At the time, you know, fuels, nothing, fertilizers, nothing. So farms are struggling right now. And so this sunset coming up is very scary because it's a time we can't afford more taxes right now. We're barely hanging on right now. And I'd like to see farms in Oregon stay family farms and not have to sell it to corporate farms. So this bill would definitely hurt family farmers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much as well. Let's hear from Marie Bowers, George Pugh, and Jerome Rosa, please. Is Marie here? Oh, here she comes. In the overflow room, huh? Yes, thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rose, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Beef is Oregon's number one industry for the past 3 years and is Oregon's second largest economic driver behind high tech. If House Bill 2859 were to pass, the exemptions and special assessments related to farms and farm equipment would be debilitating to Oregon's farms and ranchers. Farm equipment is expensive. And to maintain the use of modern and efficient equipment, and the passage of House Bill 2859 would critically burden and cripple farms and foresters. Special assessments on land assist farmers and ranchers in housing agricultural workers. To eliminate the tax exemption would require farmers and ranchers to cut production and service levels, ultimately detrimentally affecting Oregon's ability to produce products sold worldwide. House Bill 2859 would sunset agricultural exemptions, diminish the value of farming, and risk our rural farming economy. Unintentionally, this would magnify the perception that the legislature is indifferent to small rural business and the parts of our state that are struggling the most economically. The legislature faces tough budget decisions. To sunset these exemptions would be devastating to farmers and ranchers. House Bill 2859 is not good for our local farmers and ranchers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is George Pugh. I farm with my wife and my son and his family in the Shedd area. And I we'll skip to, for time, section on page 10, sections 54, and then also section 59. Section 54 is in respect for putting our farm equipment on the personal property tax review, and that will make a drastic change in our tax liabilities. Our equipment on our size of farm, which is a very medium-sized farm for our area, our equipment has farm equipment has a value of roughly $1.9 million. That's the insurance value they put on now, and as I understand, the taxes will be at the market value of that equipment, which should correspond to that. A tax at our current county rate that if placed on there would raise my tax bill by another $94,197. Now that equipment, some of it is quite old. I mean, it's 50s era. We use regularly equipment in the 70 vintage, and then we've had to purchase new equipment recently. A combine, for instance, ran us this last year is a little over $300,000 for piece of equipment. As has been stated before, that equipment isn't used only a small portion of the year, and is in itself a big expense on the farm. So I would hope that this bill, if it goes to a vote, would not contain that section. The other section, section 54, relates to the farm value. And currently, at the rate that we're charged now, I'm paying about $19,418 on this 1,400 acres that the farm actually owns. We farm more acres. To have that amount of equipment, we farm more acres, but much of it's rented. That value, if taken to the real market value, would jump again to a considerable amount and would be a burden not only on our farm, but for some of our landlords who are senior citizens who are retired from their farms or retired on their farms and rent their ground from us and depend on the income from that rental price to help them through their retirement. Currently in our area, the price for our low value lands in the South Valley are around $120 an acre. The increased tax on that acre would reduce that by about 70%. Anyway, I would hope that that these sections would be removed from review in this bill, and that you would consider our position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Marie Bowers. I'm a fifth-generation farmer that farms in Linn and Lane counties. I live in Coburg, and we also farm on both sides of Eugene. I think the real property assessment's been talked about a lot. Like, we can only do one thing with our land, and that's farm, unless you are willing to allow me to build a nice housing development for those who want to move out of Eugene. But in other news, but the equipment part is really bothersome to me. I mean, as a farm, we don't have a storefront. We don't have a factory where we make widgets. We have acres. And on our farm, our acres from one end to the other are 50 miles apart in two different counties, multiple cities. So I was trying to figure out what the number would be. I called my accountant, and I was like, so if this goes through, what would, you know, my personal property tax be? He blatantly told me, like, my record keeping would be impossible because of all the cities and counties we farm in. And we also, you know, operate. I asked my husband. He changes oil on about 50 different pieces of machinery, or engines, I should say. And we all use the equipment for different things. I mean, we have three combines because we have to get our harvest done in 6 weeks before the rain comes. That's nearly $1 million worth of equipment. To be taxed on that because the weather dictates our schedule seems a little bit ludicrous to me. And I would just urge you to oppose changing the tax assessment for farms. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mark Simmons, Elizabeth Remax, and Roger Beyer, please. they come up, I'll note that Mark is a former speaker of the Oregon House and was the speaker, my first speaker. Rogers here is, did I miss the name? Elizabeth, I may have mispronounced it. It looks like R-E-M-L-E-X, perhaps. Okay, gentlemen.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. Thank you for having the hearing on this bill today. I am here to speak in my own capacity. For the record, pardon me?
Your name?
Mark Simmons.
Thank you.
Yeah, I thought you got that for me. That's okay. I drove over from Elgin this morning. It's about 340 miles one way to have the pleasure of sitting here and visiting with you guys and just letting you know we have a piece of property there in the family. It's almost 1,500 acres, and that sounds like a lot, you know, if you're living on a lot in town. I understand that. But it's mostly rocks and cheatgrass. And you can't hardly, it's hard even to grow cows on that kind of ground. But yet we try. My nephews who are taking over the operation have both got their wives working in town to keep it afloat. You know, one's a nurse, one works for the FSA as a loan officer. And if the grand bargain that was met between land use and property taxes some years ago is undone, and all of a sudden we're required to pay much higher, you know, highest and best use values on our property taxes on our property. You know, some of those rocky hillsides with cheatgrass got a view. People might want to live there, and we'd be sitting on a gold mine if that was the case. But we're not getting rich, and we're struggling along. And this piece of legislation, if enacted as it's been explained to me and as I've read it, would undo the whole thing. We would not be able to carry on the ranch. It would just would all fall apart. So I ask, if you move this forward, that you take out the sections related to agriculture, both the personal property and the real property.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing today. I have multiple constituencies, the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Blueberry Commission, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, but also one you haven't heard from yet, because I think you've heard from all those members who are sitting behind me already, is the Western Equipment Dealers Association. The Western Equipment Dealers Association, and you should be receiving a letter from them, they represent 64 dealer locations in the state of Oregon, and they're the ones that sell the tractors and the discs and the combines and all the rest of the equipment to these farmers and ranchers that use it. This bill, if it was to pass, and specifically the piece about the personal property tax and the farm equipment, would devastate that segment of the economy. If you are taxing that equipment annually, this is specialized equipment. It is very expensive, and most of it is used very sparingly, and that's the difference between this equipment and other equipments of people in brick and mortar buildings or construction companies or people who are paying that equipment. They're using that equipment every day of the year to make a living. Our farmers, these equipment dealers, they're selling pieces of equipment that are used 25, maybe 30 days a year. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they have to have it. They can't farm without it, and to tax them at this manner would just completely put them out of business and put the dealers out of business. So you've got thousands of jobs and dealerships, over $450 million in annual sales. It would simply dry up and go away. So, Mr. Chair, I urge you to not move this bill forward, or if you choose to move the bill forward, take out the sections dealing with natural resources, the ag and the timber folks, and we'll let the rest of them speak for themselves. Mr. Chair, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Robert, is it Klinger? Is that Elizabeth?
Yeah, that's Elizabeth.
Sorry. Please come on up. Robert Klinger and Brenda, Frickleton?
Fricketick.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Association of Nurseries. The nursery industry is one of the largest ag industries in the state, and as such, our farmers rely heavily on their ability to do business. in a way that allows them to compete with other states, and that includes enjoying the same kinds of tax credits that other states give to farmers. Over the past several legislative sessions, the legislative body has passed employer and tax mandates that are having an impact on the nursery and greenhouse industry. Measures 66 and 67, minimum wage, paid sick leave, employee paid retirement, among others. We understand there are more coming this session. We certainly understand the policy discussions with each of these examples. What is less understood by the legislature, we believe, is the cumulative impact these mandates, taxes, and regulations have on the industry's ability to compete against other states. The OAN has been clear about the detrimental impacts mandates impacting labor and operational costs would have on the nursery industry. Adding complexity to these, to both the regulations and to the costs of these of our industry would hamper it and not allow it to compete with other states. We have great concerns about the cost that this bill would place on our members and our neighboring farmers. And so we urge you to not move this bill forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart, representatives. I would like to first say my name is Brenda Furkatich. It's not as scary as it looks on paper. I'm the owner of Kirsch Family Farms. I farm in St. Paul. I'm the third generation on my family's sustainable farm. We grow 11 different crops, including vegetables, vegetable seeds, grass seed, hazelnuts, wheat, and clover. I farm alongside my husband, and we have two small children as well. I actually have a handout that discusses a lot of the reasons why I oppose Senate Bill 2859 that I believe was handed out to you guys. I outline the three that I am most opposed to, that being the personal property tax, the property tax on land in exclusive farm use areas, and then also the house exemption on farmland. I'll just focus on the first two just in the essence of time, but you guys can continue to read on the other reasons. As you've heard, farming is an industry that needs an incredible amount of equipment. You've heard that from a lot of the farmers who sat up here today. And actually, on the last page of my handout, I have a picture of our barn that I took just yesterday, of our straw barn. It's full of equipment. That's where we store most of our equipment during the winter and when it's not in use and when the barn's not full of straw. That barn, I actually added up every day that, every piece in there was used last year, and it was an average of 13 days total for each piece of equipment. Some of the equipment never moved. Sometimes weather doesn't allow us to actually get out in the field and use a certain piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. Also, that barn was full of $650,000 worth of equipment. We did not have combines parked in there. I tried to be very truthful about that barn, so I didn't move all our expensive stuff in there. But I did that to show you that because of Mother Nature, we need a lot of insurances in our business. And one of those insurances is having the equipment ready to go when we need it out in the field. It is our whole year's worth of work waiting out there for us, and we have got to be able to utilize the time that we have. So we have all this equipment, but we also need to upgrade it. And I think that the personal property tax, having that on farmers, is going to really inhibit our ability to do that. Unfortunately, you know, we want, not unfortunately, but, you know, fortunately, here in Oregon, we have a legacy of farming that is strong. As a third generation, I can speak to that. I've got two little boys who are just as excited to farm as I was when I was younger. But this upgrade in equipment, it creates more reliability for us. It allows us to be more efficient. It allows us to be more competitive. It also helps us be more environmental. Some of those investments we're making into technology.
And could you cut to the chase? We're over our time.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Yes, so I've outlined a lot of the environmental benefits that we have. I also did a table speaking to the cost of what that would look like to our farm in there. And, you know, you guys already heard about the EFU land, how much that would put a burden on us. I would want to say first, or just thank you to all of you for hearing us today. Thank you to all the farmers. There's a whole room packed with farmers that are against all of this. And I would suggest to Chairman Barnhart, to your question of sunset and what we should do going forward, I would suggest possibly no sunset to this on the personal property tax side, because we do make investments in a legacy here. And then also I would suggest that we tie the EFU tax to the land use system, because as long as that is in place, I think that you have to have those benefits for farmers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Bob Klinger. I have 85 acres southwest Yamhill County. I have 25 acres of trees and the rest pasture. I run about 180 sheep. I'm a first-generation farmer. I was born and raised in Chicago. I would not have the farm if these tax advantages were not in place. And I'm not going to go into all the details. I'd like to look at bigger principles. Years back when the Balkans War was going on, every night we watched on TV as the cannonballs came from the forest land over the farmland into the cities, because those people had it set up so they maintained their fields and they maintained their forests because they remember how hungry it got during the wars. Okay, I would submit that nobody here has been hungry for 5 or 6 years. Totally. Food security is a big, important thing, and Oregon is blessed with being able to have it. But populations grow, acres do not. So if we are going to be able to continue to maintain our people, and others to boot, we have to have this advantage. That's point one. Point two is you have to look far enough down the road, especially with something like this, because every now and then something comes up that looks like a good idea, and years later we find out, like PERS, for example. How many would like to go back to before PERS happened? Okay, I left Chicago because King Richard was the day. Richard Daley was the mayor, and I couldn't live under those politics. So I came west, young man, and I've been here farming. So I would like you to continue to look far down the road and make it possible for others to continue.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that very much. Dan Eisenbeiss, Wendy Johnson.
I've never heard Daley or his King
Richard. I want to call one more, and I have it, and now I've lost it. How about Ken Van Dyke? Please. Mr. Van Dyke, why don't you go ahead?
All right, thank you. First, my name's Ken Van Dyke, and thanks for the opportunity to address the committee here. I guess, you know, a lot of the people here already have pointed out the fact that it's going to be extremely burdensome for farmers to stay in business paying the additional taxes, and I agree completely. I'm a berry grower up in Washington County, raise mostly blackberries and blueberries. We're competing with Mexico and Chile on our prices. Mexico's labor is $6 a day. We're paying $13, $14 an hour. Minimum wage keeps going up. We've been beat up bad here the last several years. My son's farming with me. He's trying to take over the farm. My son-in-law is trying to start farming on his dad's nursery. Times are tough right now. I don't think there's any room for any additional cost if we're going to stay in business, and especially for people trying to start out farming. The average age of a farmer right now in Oregon is 60 years old. We're getting a lot of gray hair. I mean, there's not going to be anybody ready to step in and take this job if they can't make a nickel. And the way things are right now, it's getting extremely difficult. So I ask you to not change the tax regulations the way they are. Leave it go as it is, and we'll try to struggle through and compete with these foreign imports the best we can. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Switching topics.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide comment today. For the record, Dan Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland would like to express concerns about provisions in the bill that would advance the sunset dates for a number of housing tax exemptions that are currently in place, including three that are currently administered at the local level by the City of Portland to promote development and additional supply of affordable housing, which we believe is very important right now. Specifically, the city implements the nonprofit low-income housing limited tax exemption, the multiple unit limited tax exemption, and the home buyer opportunity limited tax exemption. These are found respectively in sections 22, section 23, and sections 24 through 26 of the bill. The bill, as introduced, and we appreciate that this is just a starting point for discussion, would move up the sunset dates on those programs and other housing programs to the year 2020. Each of the programs that I just mentioned in recent years has been duly reviewed, revised, and extended by the legislature and has sunset dates currently in place. In addition, the multiple unit limited tax exemption is a key component of Portland's recently adopted inclusionary housing policy, which builds upon the authorization that was granted by the legislature in the 2016 session. So we believe that it's appropriate to review each of these programs, but have concerns about the impacts of advancing that sunset date, the inherent timelines for acquisition of land and development of housing take time, and 2020 is not very far out. I would draw your attention in Section 24 of the bill to language that advances the sunset for the homebuyer opportunity limited tax exemption that says after an exemption is approved, the builder has 2 years to construct the home, or they must do so before the sunset date that's prescribed, whichever happens earlier. 2020 would only be 1 year out from the scheduled review date in 2019. So we would encourage the committee to leave the current sunset dates in place for these programs if the bill moves forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities today. On OLIS, I've submitted testimony that's just an excerpt from the League of Oregon Cities property tax report, just to kind of give you the big picture of what we're talking about with all the exemptions. The League supports the concept of this bill and not necessarily all the details, and appreciate that it's a starting point. There are over 130 property tax exemptions on the books. And just as you deal with the tax credits on the income tax side, tax credits mean less revenue coming in. The same thing with property tax exemptions. And some of these exemptions have never been reviewed again. And some of them perhaps shouldn't be reviewed again. Perhaps the farm one is a good example that that we don't need to be looking at that one so in such detail.
Got that idea.
I got that idea. But there are a lot of economic development exemptions that were put in place, for example, for an industry at a particular time that maybe that industry doesn't have the same need that it does today. There are a lot of housing incentives and exemptions in there that perhaps need predictability, and so we don't need to be upping those sunsets. But the short of it is we applaud the effort to take a look at local government exemptions, because the legislature has taken that revenue away from local governments and schools, and to make sure that we have that discussion again of are we really getting a return on our investment? Is it an appropriate exemption? So just to give you the numbers, in 2014-15, that's a fiscal year, not a biennium, property taxes brought in $5.5 billion. $1.2 billion of it was for cities, and over $3.6 billion was for schools. The rest go to counties and school districts. What we exempted was $12 billion in exemption. So more than double we exempted what we took in. So that's how big it is. And as I said, you can look online to see the chart of the three categories of exemptions that generally the Department of Revenue tracks of business, social welfare, and public exemptions. So the public exemptions are a huge part of it, you know, the federal land and such, public property and such. But there's a lot of dollars going out
there. That's what I just asked staff.
Right. So
the fact is that most of that $12 billion is publicly owned property.
It's true. The total, this is the first time that the business category, though, out revenue lost, I don't know how to put that in verb, the social welfare one. So I think that reflects the fact, though, that with our economy and our revenue system, it's not working so well. More and more we're relying on property taxes and local incentives rather than state incentives for economic development. So the business exemptions have gone up over time, more even over the social welfare ones. So that's the why we care. You have some choices on how you deal with the details. A sunset may or may not be the right way. And I just want to remind, especially the folks in the room, that just having a sunset does not mean it would go away. The way the legislature has looked at sunsets with tax credits, it just means it gets on the list to review at that session and decide whether to extend the sunset or not. So just by pure having a sunset doesn't mean an exemption would go away, but it would just require it to be reviewed ahead of the sunset happening. So, but you could also do a different method.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, panel. We appreciate your testimony. I'm going to loop back now and pick up where we left off. Gilbert Shipley, Sarah Demling, Scott Hansen, please. Yes, ma'am. Please go ahead.
My name's Sarah Doimling. I have family forest land in Polk County. Fifth generation going on sixth and seventh. I have to admit that all my points have been taken, and I appreciate everything that's been said. You ask for advice. I think you should take the farm and forest land deferrals off your list of things to sunset. Mm-hmm. And
I'm getting that impression.
I think that it's going to be much, much harder for us to stay in business and much harder to convince the next generation that this is something they ought to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen. Go
ahead. Chair Barnhart and Vice Chairs Bentz and Smith-Warner, I mention you two because I'm Gilbert Shibley. I live in at 24750 South Wallens Road, Estacada, Oregon, on forest and farm property owned by my family since so long ago as 1864. The reason I referred to the vice chairs is that they represent very different districts.
They do.
From each other and from me. I'm sort of in between. So I, too, have had many of my points made before. I want to tell you that we have two different family-owned LLCs, and I'm the forester for both of them. And I averaged up the change in valuation if this would happen, and it averages 15-fold, not 25 like the first woman, Marcia Carr, in the first panel said, but it ranges from 11 to 41 times increase. And so... But now I'd just like to quote from the Oregon Small Woodlands website, and I think it's almost the same words on the Oregon Department of Revenue. Because forest lands are important to Oregon's economic and environmental health, the Oregon legislature established a special assessment of program for forest land. This was designed to recognize the importance of forest land to Oregon's economy and respond to the growing pressures that urban growth was putting on the value and property tax assessments on natural resource land. And living between the urban area and the forested hills, that's why my change would be so great, because the quote, real market value, would be reflecting that other higher value.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Scott Hansen, Chair and committee members. Again, many of the points I've raised on my paper have already been mentioned, so I don't want to go into them again. I will bring you back, though, to a couple points here. 44 years ago, on May 1973, there was historic Oregon legislation that enacted and created the Land Conservation Development Commission, and through the approval of Senate Bill 100. This was a watershed event. That said, Oregonians must preserve agricultural and forest land for future generations while accommodating population growth in our state. And many forest land owners bought into this agreed path. And I guess the point I wanted to raise to all you folks is just forestry is a long-term venture, and it requires some certainty of variables that are moving around out there. And so that's why I'm saying no to House Bill 2859. It would just kind of flips the apple cart over in a nutshell. So, and you have my testimony.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. Scott Russell, Dennis Morgan, Don, looks like Gersowski, perhaps. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Chairman Barnhart, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to talk. My name is Scott Russell, and I live in Columbia County. You have my testimony. So I'm not going to duplicate what's already been said, but I'd like to point out a few highlights that maybe haven't been said. We're working with a 50 to 80 year crop. A 6-year sunset doesn't do us much good. When you have a crop that long, it's a challenge to get the next generation involved, especially in today's world of immediate satisfaction. Although this is immediate satisfaction compared to a 300-year rotation in Montana. Mm-hmm. So to convince the next generations that they're going to be harvesting trees that somebody else planted, and they're planting trees that the future generations will harvest, is a pretty big deal. There's a lot of farms that go away because that the knowledge and passion to do that is not passed on. So another thing, along with what was mentioned by some of the farm people, the food that you're eating, and the wood in this panel, the chairs you're sitting on, not to mention the toilet paper that a lot of us enjoy, is created by the people sitting in this room and thousands more throughout the state. And eliminating the current tax situation we have will destroy that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chairman Barnhart, committee members, my name is Dennis Morgan. I'm from Jackson County. My wife and I live on 96 acres of forest land outside of Rogue River. And we purchased the property in 2003 when we moved to Oregon. We had a house built on the property and moved on site in 2005. The property had been high graded about 30 years before we bought it. It was severely overstocked, unhealthy, and a real fire hazard. I'm convinced that it previously was a poison oak preserve, quite frankly. Yes. And maybe blackberry preserve, too. But we spent thousands of dollars over the last 12 years removing slash and thinning to improve the health of the forest and the fire safety of the property. Our property is a great place to live. We love it. But we also felt that we would be able to draw some supplemental income during our retirement from timber harvests. HB 2859 would mean that most, if not all, of our profits from the selective harvesting we plan to do would be go to pay the increased property taxes caused by the sunsetting of the forest use exemptions. Oregon is a special place to live. That's why my wife and I decided to retire here. Two contributors to the Oregon's special quality are the private forest lands and farmlands that are found throughout the state. Several years ago, the legislature realized the value of these lands to the quality of life in Oregon. In their wisdom, they established the farm and forest use special assessments to enable families to keep those lands in production. I hope that this legislature will have the wisdom to kill HB 2859. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Don Sersowski. I come to you in opposition to this bill. My family owns and operates a small century farm in Linn County. We are currently trying to transition the operation to the next generation. I don't know if this will happen. In the last several meetings of the legislature, small, especially labor-intensive farms have been hit with all kinds of expensive rules and regulations concerning who we hire, how we compensate them, and working conditions that do not work in a natural resource community. If I could magically pick up my farm and move it to another state, I would. Again, as I said, the legislature is again trying to break promises it made to us decades ago. When the state legislature passed land use laws to protect our natural resources and those who would produce and protect them, it was understood that family farms, woodlot owners, and others related in the national resource fields would be impacted with restrictions that would make their properties less valuable on this real estate market and make it much harder to parcel out small lots for greater value. This is why the farm deferral assessment came to law. These same conditions apply today as they did then. We are faced with the problem of urbanization on some of our most productive land in Oregon. The farm deferral helps to balance the pressure to sell. The personal property exemption for farms and ranches you've heard about. I have to have several trucks to harvest my fields. They operate less than 300 miles a year. Yet I pay the same taxes and fees on those trucks as a long-haul trucker that goes out and puts 100,000 miles on that same truck that year. It is for these reasons that we need to maintain these and not ever sunset them. If this law were to come into effect, it would be the final straw that makes my farm unprofitable, and yet another family farm that has survived for generations and for over a century will become history. What a sad legacy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Tamara Cushing, Bruce Chapin, and Nancy Hathaway, please. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Tamara Cushing. I have a PhD in forest economics, and I've spent all of my schooling studying taxes and tax systems, specifically as they relate to forest land. There are studies out there that ask, what are the biggest barriers to forest management? What are the problems facing forest landowners? And consistently, one of the top answers is property taxes, and that's above income taxes, and income taxes usually are viewed as that bigger dollar amount. But there's something about that property tax. It's the fact that that's coming up every year. And then as someone who studies tax principles, one of the good principles of taxes is when they match the income. And this is one of those that just doesn't do it, right? Every year that tax bill comes and there's no cash flow. And if you look at a forest operation where many, many years go by without a cash flow that's positive, this is a real drain. And so if you sit there and you think about what that looks like from a cash flow standpoint, and I can tell you from running cash flows all over this country, this is kind of ugly. And the bigger these taxes get, the uglier it gets. The opportunity cost, when you start running that in there at a 4% discount rate with no income until year 20, year 30, it really starts to paint a pretty ugly picture. So around the country, we see these current use programs in place on property taxes on forests and ranch and farmlands, and they're there to really encourage good management, good operations, and they're often there as a reward for that. Without those breaks, it does become cost prohibitive. And often what we're looking at is the fact that we're trying to compensate for things that aren't being compensated. These forest landowners manage their land. They provide the clean air, the clean water that we all enjoy in the state, the wildlife habitat that we all like to see. And then, of course, there's the aesthetics. As someone who moved here, Oregon was always such this beautiful place, these big trees. And those big trees, in a lot of cases, belong to the people that sit in this room. And they're managing for those trees, and they're managing for all those benefits that we all take advantage of for free. These special assessments help these landowners provide these services, and I just urge you to think about what this will mean to those particular landowners. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Hathaway. Of Corvallis, Oregon, and I operate tree farms in Benton and Polk mostly. But I'm a second generation, but I'm nurturing the third and fourth generation. And one of the things I always want to tell my 14-year-old grandson is that, see these trees? They should be grown to 50 to 70 years old. But with this bill, I think there's going to be a steady march to the mill. And you might as well take a John Philip Sousa tune and rename it, March to the Mill, because all those hills that are covered with trees now, which is really Oregon's money in the bank, because we will all pay taxes when we harvest those trees, so that's money that Oregon has coming. They'll be gone in steady march year after year. There's no point in maintaining something that has limited and reduced value. It would be equal to the stock market crash that has happened over time, but with no recovery. And I'm sure you remember Oregon's
recession, I guess that's what we're calling it. It's taken us years to recover from that. I think the law is written to keep forests as forests. But this reduction, this House Bill 2859, would encourage people to harvest their trees as soon as they could. And it's a rare occasion for all of us to be here talking to you, but it's a rare occasion for you to see all of us cleaned up. Because yesterday, I guarantee you, many of us had muddy boots and muddy jeans. So, in conclusion, just remember, farming and forestry is risky business.
Thank you very much. It's an ill wind that blows no good at all, isn't it? Please.
Or no deed. Good deed goes unpunished.
Maybe that's it, too.
I was covered with mud just a few hours ago.
Oh, you cleaned up fast.
Yeah. I'm Bruce Chapin, third-generation orchardist farming just north of Kaiser. I urge you to oppose this bill. The bill creates sunsets, eliminate the appropriate use of income approach to appraising farmland values. Appraising real estate using the income approach is not limited to farm and forest land. It is used in all types of income properties. Very common throughout the rest of the business world. The Oregon Department of Revenue publication Appraisal Methods, page 32, chapter 6, states, always consider using the income approach to appraise income-producing properties. Mm-hmm. Notice the first word, always. Farmland is an income-producing property, and therefore the appropriate method to appraise farmland is to use the income approach. In contrast, the selling price of farmland is strongly influenced to perceive future non-farm uses, and speculation resulting in unrealistic farm values. For the tax assessors to discontinue assessing farmland in EFU zone based on the income approach will devastate the agricultural industry, creating more pressure to convert farmland to other uses. Also, this bill creates a sunset to eliminate the farm use special assessment for the farm home sites. Understand that the house is an essential part of our operation. On our farm, the farm office is in our house. Please realize the reason my farmers live on the farm is to make it more efficient. I need to be there day and night to be able to quickly react to emergencies. Greenhouse heaters have to be monitored when it gets cold in the middle of the night, and ventilation adjusted on hot Sunday afternoons to avoid overheating. Easy to do when I'm living right there. Hazelnut dryers need to be checked frequently, both day and night, to avoid overdrying nuts. And there's also the constant need to be there to minimize theft and vandalism. Also, this bill sunsets the personal property tax exemption for farm equipment. And it's been stated multiple times, we don't use this equipment very darn often. And my farm is no exception on that. Most of my stuff is used less than 10% of the year. The impact of this bill will have on farm families is devastating, and would please vote no on this. Let me just close by pointing out that in the orchard business, we need to be long-term planners. We need to think long-term. In order to do that, we need a stable government. We need a stable taxing system. Eliminate the sunsets. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much. Doug Durst, Sam Sweeney, Tyler Alexander, please.
What they said about injuries on farms.
Oh, boy. Ha.
Remember.
I think they're coming in from the other room. Please come right up here. Thank you.
Okay, I guess I'll start.
Please.
Chairman and committee members, my name's Doug Durst. I'm a fourth-generation farmer on my family farm. We have a century farm near Silverton, Oregon. I urge you to oppose House Bill 2859. This bill hurts family farmers and ranchers across the state and threatens the preservation of farmland. House Bill 2859 would sunset personal property tax exemptions for farm equipment that were passed to recognize the unique situation of machinery use in agriculture. The equipment we need to cultivate and harvest our crops is very expensive and specialized, unlike equipment for other industries, which is used all year long to produce income. Our farm equipment is only used a small portion of the year. An example is the combine. We use it about 30 days a year. It costs very much, and we only use it in the summer harvest season to bring our seed crops in. It is stored in the shed, as you've heard, about 11 months out of the year. No income is produced during that time of the year. All our inputs into our crops are done year-long, and we have to bring that out during that harvest season. So it's really a timely situation. We got to fight weather and all the things. So we need to get this job done so that we can keep sustaining our farm. That expensive personal property tax for farm equipment would make it not feasible to own or operate our farm and threaten the continued existence of our farm for future generations. House Bill 2859 also eliminates the farm use property tax assessment and threatens Oregon's land use system. Farm use and home site assessments keep farmland in production. These special assessments reflect the value for agriculture productivity and no other uses that may justify a higher assessment. The farm use and home site special assessments are critical to keep working lands working and preserve for future farming generations. I'm an advocate for protecting our farmland. Our land use laws were created to do this in the early 1970s. We have a good history of protecting our farmland in Oregon. Let's continue to do it. Does the legislature really want to tax farmers more and still not allow them to develop their farm for the greatest gain? In 2004, a ballot measure 37 passed. It said that private real property owners must receive just compensation if regulation causes a devaluation of private property. If House Bill 2859 passes, I am sure there will be a push to enact a ballot measure 37 claim or change the land use laws that may open farmland up to development. I don't want to see that happen. House Bill 2859 is not necessary and would be devastating to farm families and farm employees. Let's keep our common sense system so that we can protect and encourage family farms in Oregon. Please vote no on House Bill 2859 and support Oregon farmers and ranchers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name's Tyler Alexander. I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. OFB is the largest grassroots agricultural association representing about 7,000 farm families and ranching families in Oregon. As you probably know by now, OFB strongly opposes HB 2859 due to the bill's negative impacts on agriculture and the natural resources industry as a whole.
And just to be clear, I assume you're referring to the parts of the bill that have to do with natural resources.
Absolutely, sections.
You're not talking about the other parts.
Right, right.
Thank you.
But I'll be brief because I think you've heard a lot from folks and can't say it any better. Just on the personal property tax exemptions, I think there's a few points that are pretty important to emphasize. You've heard a lot about the high cost of equipment. It's important to note that this is further compounded by the fact that growers are planting many different crops already to kind of spread out the financial risk. Restricting the use of equipment is going to be restricting the use of crops. Oregon prides itself on having over 220 different varieties. It'd be a shame and would certainly be a kind of an unintended consequence of that action. Moreover, I mean, a lot of it's been alluded to, but the workforce mandates that have been handed down recently have caused a trend where many of the farmers who at least can afford to have been leveraging their operations to purchase more equipment because they're in the process of mechanization. This would be one of the worst possible times to bring something like this on the table. And in conclusion, I'd just kind of like to bring up that, you know, a lot has been talked about the land use system, and certainly that probably isn't something that should be assessed every 6 years. But I'd just kind of like to state that the personal property is something that's so inextricably linked to the real property that it's just not fair. Farmers and ranchers don't plan their operations on six-year cycles, and these aren't something, you know, that would necessarily be consistent with that. So I'd like to thank you.
That's definitely the impression we've gotten so far.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chairman Barnhart, and committee members. My name is Sam Sweeney, for the record. I live at 1070 Ferry Street, Dayton, Oregon, 97114. I'm part of a multi-generational farm that farms a wide variety of crops in Yamhill County. And I'm opposed to House Bill 2859. And a large part of Oregon's economy is based on the ability of Oregon farmers to produce high-quality farm commodities, not only for Oregon and out-of-state consumers, but also for export to global markets. And there are many reasons why Oregon's agricultural economy is robust and successful. And one reason is that in past legislative sessions, it was recognized that in order for agriculture to flourish and be competitive, farmland needed to be protected from non-farm use. Out of this need came the historic land use bill, Senate Bill 100, that to a large degree protects Oregon's farmland base and prevents non-farm speculative market values. It was also recognized that farmland taxation based on sales market values, similar to taxation formulas on residential or commercial values, when applied to agricultural farmland, would result in unfair taxation and be an impediment to the agricultural industry. From this knowledge came a much fairer way to tax farmland, which is based on rental rates of farmland indexed to soil types and their productive capabilities and other improvements. With the protection of farmland from speculative non-farm values and fair taxation rates, farmers feel safer in planning for the future and producing valuable commodities that Oregon needs and is recognized for. House Bill 2859 would remove this protective exemption in the year 2020. It is my understanding House Bill 2859 would also remove an exemption that would result in taxing farm machinery that is required by farmers in the production of agricultural Oregon's commodities. This would result in farm machinery being taxed at the same rate as commercial and industrial machinery that is used continually and year-round. In contrast, agricultural machinery is only used approximately several weeks out of a year. This industrial form of taxation is unfair to agriculture, and if enacted, would raise the price of commodities. This cost would either be passed on to consumers, or more likely, would be absorbed by the farmers, decreasing their profitability. In summary, if enacted, 2859 would result in unfair treatment penalizing Oregon's agricultural system. Eventually, I think, it will weaken Oregon's land use laws that are necessary to protect the state's highly productive soils. Oregon agriculture is a large part of Oregon's economical base, benefiting all of its citizens in many different ways, and deserves to be protected and treated fairly. Therefore, I strongly urge you to reject House Bill 2859, and I really appreciate this opportunity to present this testimony.
Thank you very much, and thank very much those who've traveled some distance today to describe your views and give us information about your businesses. I think this is the kind of hearing that the legislature and these committees are set up to do. Yeah. So that we get the kinds of laws that Oregon needs. I think I'm not speaking for the committee, only for myself. It seems pretty clear that there's some general agreement about natural resources property tax issues, that if we need to have a sunset cycle, it needs to be a lot longer than 6 years, that any kind of a cycle that we would establish would put in jeopardy the long-term planning for equipment purchases, for housing, and for land use, and then a whole variety of other issues, including the things that just came up, having to do with the varieties of crops and the like. And I know I've skipped a whole bunch of things in a quick summary. Because we went through it so quickly, I have a couple of other witnesses who want to testify, but I'm going to hold them over for a later hearing because they're here often. But what I'd like to do is ask committee. We have 5 or 6 minutes. It's a little unusual for me to do it this way, but if there are burning questions, while we've got the witnesses who in the room, this would be a great time to ask them. And then I'm going to suggest how we might proceed from here while we're still in hearing. Representative Smith-Warner, and these are not just for the people who are at the podium now. If somebody else has an answer to a question, feel free to come back up. We have to get you back on the mic in order to get it on the record. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank everyone for their testimony. The one gentleman who pointed out Representative Benson and I and how we come from very different parts, and that is true. And at the same time, Representative Bentz actually represents all of my in-laws because my husband's family are ranchers in eastern Oregon. So there is a greater degree of knowledge, I believe, and understanding on this committee than you might think just on the face of it. And I would just like to point out that what you all talked about here today is a part of the difficult decision that we have. Everyone comes and says to us, you need to do cuts, you need to find more revenue, but all anybody can tell us is what we can't cut and what more revenue we can't do because it will have a negative impact on your bottom line, on your ability to function. And I believe I speak for my colleagues, all respect that. And I will just say only for myself, I would say tax credits are, it's part of the budgeting process, the tax credits that we do, whether they're property taxes or business taxes. We need your help. In addition to letting us know what you don't think makes sense, help us. Where else can we cut? What other places are there? What are other sources? This, I think, was just a good example of it's easy to just look at big numbers and say, oh, there's a bunch of revenue that we're foregoing there. Yet, as you clearly demonstrated, there are lots of good policy reasons and why we want to do it this way. And I would just ask all of you to think, okay, this is why it's so hard. This is why it's not just easy to say, oh, sure, let's just cut these other guys three things, and then we'll balance the budget. And I would sincerely say, bring us ideas, because this is a hard thing, and we really need your help to do it.
Could I respond to that,
please?
Representative Smith?
Yeah.
You know, those of us in agriculture, when we have a budget problem, we start looking at ways to cut expenses and make things a lot more efficient and streamlined. And so I think a lot of us would say, you need to look at government and see if there's ways that you can streamline that and make it more efficient and cut out the waste.
Thank you. And, of course, that's partly what we are doing in this process. When we look at various tax breaks, we want to make certain that they actually accomplish the purposes that they're intended for. I think the testimony we've heard today makes it very clear that that is the case for the natural resources tax breaks. Again, speaking only for myself, not for the committee. But we haven't heard very much about or anything at all about the economic development tax breaks that are on our list or some of the nonprofit ones. But I appreciate that. From our budget standpoint, there's two parts of the budget. One is the money we actually spend on programs, and the other is the revenue that we forego based on the way we target specific businesses or industries. I think the argument today has been made very, very clear that the natural resources property tax system that we have set up already is necessary in order to provide for the kinds of outcomes that you've testified to. I think that's quite clear. We're not so sure necessarily about the other areas because they're not here to testify. And Representative Vance wants to say something or ask something, and then I have a proposal to make to the committee before we leave and get your feedback so we can sort of figure out how to proceed with this. Representative Benson and then Representative Fernandez. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sure want to thank everybody for being here. It's absolutely great to hear from you and some really, really good testimony, some great ideas. Because of my ranching and farming background, when I hear the word tax breaks, when it's applied to the farm deferral, I kind of shudder. Because as the chair got close to saying, it's not so much a tax break as it is an adjustment for the type of situation we who farm and ranch find ourselves put in by virtue of other laws. So it's hard to say that that's a tax break.
I'll accept that.
Right.
Thank you.
And I think we as a committee are challenged constantly with the way that words have emerged over time describing these different, sometimes extremely convoluted arrangements when it comes to taxes. So you're to be forgiven, Mr. Chair, for using that word. I'm sick. But on the other hand, this is an area that requires an awful lot of work, a lot of careful thinking. But it's really great to have all of you here and to remind us just how important some of these decisions are when it comes to long-term planning. We truly understand that. And so, Mr. Chair, I look forward to further discussions on these issues because they're so incredibly important when we're working on such small margins, as is the case in the farm and ranching community, subject to all of the challenges posed by international commodity markets and the like. So, but I can assure everyone here that this is a very considerate group, but your appearance here today is extremely valuable, and yes. Very, very happy to see you here.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Hernandez, please.
Just have a few points, and one, I want to thank folks for coming here. It's been really enlightening for me to learn and how complex the reality of any type of tax expenditure, particularly around property tax. I represent East Portland, which for the most part doesn't have any type of land. I mean, farmland. 99.9% sure of that. Most of my former ancestors were farm workers. My dad's a farm worker. My grandpa's a farm worker, and I come from migrant farm workers. one of the points I wanted to make is I'm new. I just got elected, and I'm learning a lot about the reality of government, what we spend money on, how we collect revenue, the complexity of it all. And similarly, what I found is this narrative that exists, which, you know, I kind of don't like this idea that there are some folks who say, hey, we need to get rid of every type of tax credit we have to collect more revenue, to do more good in our society. And then there's the we need to cut government spending and this vice versa type of narrative that exists. And as I can tell, it's obviously much more complicated than that simplistic narrative that exists. This is why it's important for us who represent certain parts get to know all of Oregon and want to represent all of Oregon. And me being able to learn about the realities of what the agricultural industry deals with allows me to then be able to make a decision that's informed. Our offices get a lot of folks who come talk to us about different things that the government does, right? Whether it's social services, whether it's education, et cetera. If we were to cut even some of those resources, then we'll have, similarly to you all, a room packed full of folks who find so much value to what we provide, and it becomes that complex even on that end too. So anyway, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to make a proposal to the committee while the witnesses are still here. We've got this list and I asked it to be printed out rather than just giving it to you on the computer, because so you have something you can write some notes on. But we've got two and a quarter very closely spaced pages, a list of these property tax considerations and only less than a page of them are the ones that most of the testimony has been about today, the natural resources ones. What I'm going to propose is that we do two things with this bill right off the top. One is that we eliminate from consideration the ones that the natural resources tax expenditure portions that we've heard testimony about today, and that's most of them from consideration for any change. I'm pretty convinced that putting a sunset on these things that actually are very long-term assets doesn't make any sense. And that we also eliminate from consideration the ones where there's already a current law sunset in place. We've heard testimony about the housing developments, for example, with a sunset of December 31st, 2025, I think the fourth item. And the proposed sunset of 6/30/20, I'm fairly convinced that it doesn't make sense given the time we have for us to spend time talking about changing those sunsets, and that we concentrate on the half a page or so that's left as we consider this bill further, and that we schedule another hearing where the where we announce in advance that we're going to talk about those pieces, and that if the bill moves forward, and any amendment that we have will include the two things I've just said. Is anybody have a significantly different idea than that for the next iteration of our work on this bill? I don't see anybody. All right. Thank you all so much. Thank you, witnesses, for coming today. You should consider that all of what I just said means you win. When we post the bill, it will still have the same material in it, but the amendments that we're going to consider will take it out. Okay? All right. Thank you so much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2859 and the committee 859 and the committee public hearing on House Bill 20.